Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden and you're listening to Season 4, Episode 14 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. As always, I would direct you to the show notes for a comprehensive running order of what we covered and when in this episode. But to give you the usual teaser, we looked at Sevilla's short, medium and long-term concerns. We looked at the wider significance of Lazio's Derby de la Capital victory over Roma, and we spoke to Albert and Barney from the Long Ball Football podcast to get the view from Portugal ahead of Sporting's Europa League quarter-final with Juventus and Inter's Champions League quarter-final with Benfica. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. This episode is, of course, produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. The intention for the final part of this podcast actually had been to speak to Alex and the Nad from the Everybody's Eats League and podcast, but sadly, for several reasons, that didn't quite happen this time around. You'll hear me actually in the first section of the podcast referencing that discussion. At that point, we thought the discussion was going to take place. Sadly, it didn't materialise, but what we can say is that the discussion will now take place in Season 4, Episode 15, which will be with you in a fortnight's time. And as part of that discussion, we are going to look at the five young players who have played the most minutes in Ligue 1 this season, as highlighted by our friends at Scouted Football. And looking at those young players, we're going to talk about playing style, we're going to talk about potential, we're going to talk more generally about what it is that makes those players such bright prospects. So do tune in for that one as well in a fortnight's time. In the meantime, hopefully you enjoy this episode, hopefully you learn a thing or two, or perhaps even three. Hopefully you're all staying safe, hopefully you're all staying well. Enjoy. Well, Rory Barlow and I are on cloud nine after Scotland's win over Spain last night. Rory Barlow, of course, enjoying that game in Spain. And I'm sure, no doubt, rubbing it into some of his Spanish friends in Madrid. Yeah, Rory Barlow, how, firstly, was it watching that game in Madrid? And secondly, more generally, how are you doing?
More generally, how am I doing? Yeah, cloud nine. I was pretty delighted after last night. In terms of how was that watching it in Madrid, I have to say I probably didn't have the most Spanish experience of it, given the place I was consuming Scotland's victory was called Paddy's. So that gives you something of an idea of where I was watching it. But it was, I did enjoy it with, I think there was about 8-9 of us Scots in the downstairs, in the dingy dark downstairs, enjoying Scotland's victory. And yeah, I think a lot of Spain has been pretty kind of fair enough to Scotland for an excellent victory.
It's glad to hear that they've been a little bit more gracious in defeat than a certain Rodri, shall we say. Okay, well, focusing on this episode, we have quite a varied agenda for this episode. We are going to talk about Spain, of course, with you, Rory Barlow. We're going to have a section looking at Road to Nowhere at the Games, so to speak. We're going to talk about my recent trip to Rome to see the Derby de la Capital between Roma and Lazio. We're going to speak to Albert and Barney from the Long Ball Football podcast about some of the Portuguese teams who will be facing up against some Italian sides in the Champions League and Europa League. Very varied agenda, but where better to start than in Spain? Now, Sevilla have been an all too regular feature on the Road to Nowhere podcast this season for all the wrong reasons. But we couldn't ignore another telenovela twist in Andalusia this international break. With Manchester United on the horizon and Sevilla hovering above the drop zone, former Eibar icon and Road to Nowhere favourite José Luis Mendilibar has been given the reins to save Sevilla from disaster. Take us through the gory details, Barlow.
Yeah, no, it was another sacking, very dramatic in Andalusia and in Seville, where it feels like it has been nothing but drama all season. Sampaoli went after Getafe, beat Sevilla 2-0 sort of just before the international break, and I think that was a nail in the coffin. It's felt a wee bit like he's needed to win games to keep his job for a few weeks now. And this comes despite the fact that, and as we were talking about on the Road to Nowhere podcast a few weeks ago, a few episodes ago, there have been improvements. This was a team that deep into February had a perfect record at home. It's a side that's been getting through the Europa League ties that they've been tasked with, and were doing things well in certain aspects, and looks like they had a bit more enthusiasm, a bit more zest. Pape Gueye has come into the midfield and looked very good as well. But overall, there was sort of perhaps discontent's the wrong word, but there were certainly disturbances. There were rumblings of players not being quite happy. And what I found interesting is generally you get these sacking statements from clubs and they tend to be pretty banal. They tend to be thank you for your work, best of luck in the future. But Sevilla actually gave the reasons that they'd sacked him. They said that, look, this guy hasn't removed us from the relegation battle. We're still towards the bottom end of the table. The point has been made by others that they were only a point clear of the relegation zone when Sampaoli took the job, and they're now 2 points clear, which isn't enough improvement, frankly, for a Sevilla side that has plenty more than they are showing right now. And the image of the team, this is a side that got beaten by Atleti 6-1. They were absolutely thumped by them. That Getafe defeat, it was pretty grim in the sense that Getafe, I mean, it was a bad game. It was back and forth a little bit, but Getafe managed to kind of deal with Sevilla pretty effectively. They created openings, and away from home, they have really struggled to kind of put in these performances. So yeah, it's a side that's been struggling away from home. You got Marcos Acuña, who as we were saying, I think we commented on it last time, but there's the scene where a bit of paper gets sent onto the pitch, A4 bit of paper. There's two players looking at it, and Marcos Acuña, World Cup winner, comes over, grabs it out of the hand, scrunches it up and chucks it on the floor. That tells you that at least one player didn't fully believe in his tactics. And then against Atleti, sort of after the match, he's the one that comes out as well, interestingly, and makes a point of saying, look, either we're not understanding what the manager wants, or he's failing to sort of convey exactly what we need to do, because something here isn't working, when they got beat 6-1. And then the following week, Yassine Bounou comes out and kind of eases off a little bit, it has to be said. He says, yeah, okay, the players are confused as to what Sampaoli or the manager wants. And he says, okay, that's partly on the players. We have a responsibility to make these things work as well. But certainly it kind of lets slip the fact that there is a widespread understanding within that squad. And you look at Sevilla this season, Bono and Acuña are probably their two best players. And so if your two best players are saying that tactically, in terms of what we've been asked to do, this is a bit of a mess, yeah, it tells you that that's not a happy dressing room, and that Sampaoli maybe had to go. I think I would have been tempted to try and see out the season with him, just because they had to pay him $8 million for his 6 months of work, which is a pretty pretty nice payoff if you're Sampaoli, and kudos to his agent for getting that deal done. But yeah, we've got Mendilibar coming in. I think in many ways, the thing that he's going to do best is not be Sampaoli. He's always struck me as kind of a manager that's very sure of his ideas, that's very strong in terms of what he wants to do and exactly how he's going to set up his teams. But his first kind of press conferences, he said, we're going to assess what we have here. We're going to adapt to what the players that we have, and hopefully they'll adapt to a little what we have. He's been kind of very softly catching monkey with his statements so far. And I think that's a reaction to Sampaoli, who again is a manager that more so than most, and certainly he's a disciple of Bielsa, that phrase that everybody loves to put out, and it makes you wonder if Bielsa is going to write a football Bible at some point. But moving back to Mendilibar, yeah, he's been a lot more kind of soft than Sampaoli would be, and Sampaoli is very much direct, aggressive. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to set up. We're going to play out from the back. He's been using three at the back consistently throughout the season since he came in, despite the fact they don't really have either centre-backs fit or centre-backs that are playing well. So I think, yeah, that kind of shoehorning this Sevilla side into Sampaoli's style has not gone down too well with the squad. Whereas Mendilibar, I think he's going to play how he always does play, but the way he's going about it and the way he's talking about it is going to benefit them. That basic kind of premise of being a bit more sort of kind of open to change, to compromise with your players, I think that's going to go down well with the Sevilla side, with the Sevilla squad that has strong personalities. And I think he'll go back to basics with Ibar. I think 4-4-2. I think it'll be a lot of wing play. Brian Gila, I think, depending on how his injury and his fitness holds up after the Spain duty, I think he'll be a key part of the side. There'll be a lot of hard work. There'll be a high line, but it'll be relatively simple and basics. And he once said when he was in charge of Ibar, we are the most simple team in Spain to scout because we do the same thing every week. And I think that might benefit Sevilla. Just looking kind of a bit more long-term, though, I do think it is a concerning situation for the Sevilla side, who aren't going to have any European income for next season. They are, unless they win the Europa League, which I don't think they're going to, given they're up against Manchester United, but never count Sevilla out. But I was kind of just going through their squad. 11 of their squad members are over 30. You look at the ones kind of under 30 that are permanent members of the squad, it's really not that very many that you'd want to keep around. I mean, Montiel's a decent player. Oli Torres is decent, if not fantastic. And Nasiri and Mir, if they put their games together, perhaps they will be that forward, but they never are so far. And I was looking at that squad and I was going through them. I don't think there's a single player that the likes of Villarreal, Real Sociedad, Atleti even, that would go through that squad, take one of those players and say, yeah, let's make him an important part of our team. Maybe Acuña is the only one, and he has been very good. But yeah, there's just not a lot of talent on the Sevilla side, or certainly not a lot that I believe can take them forward next season. So they're going to have a reshuffle. They're going to have a rebuild job in the summer. But given they're probably not going to have too many resources to do it with, it is kind of worrying for Sevilla going forward, it has to be said.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of veterans, one that they should have had in their ranks is Joselu Mato. The Espanyol striker made his international debut, of course, last week against Norway. There was no Erling Haaland, but the giant Joselu came on in the 81st minute, and by the 85th, he had already bagged a brace. Now, some eagle-eyed Premier League fans may remember him from his spells at Stoke City and Newcastle United, but how has Joselu earned his first international cap at the ripe old age of 33, Barlow?
I have to admit, I've got a wee bit of a soft spot for Joselu, and perhaps maybe Scottish fans now a bit more familiar with him aren't quite as soft on him as I would be. But I mean, yeah, okay, does he do the dark arts of the game? Absolutely. It's very much part of his repertoire as a target man, as a something who's forward that he is. And yeah, so he came out of the Castilla Academy at Real Madrid. He's tall, he's gangly, he's young, but he's been scoring goals. He scored, I think, about 30 goals across two seasons for the Castilla Academy. And without ever being prolific through much of his career, he kind of passed through a lot of teams then. He went to Germany. He's got German parentage. He was born, I think, in Germany as well. And before moving back to Galicia as a child and kind of growing up there. And he went through Hoffenheim. He went through Eintracht, Hanover, Stoke City, Deportivo, then Newcastle. And he arrives at Alaves at 29. He's never hit 10 goals in a league season, just solely in the league, in his entire career, which is pretty, it tells you that he's useful enough to keep getting his teams, and he does a job as a target man, but he doesn't have that prolific touch. And then he goes to Alaves, who were consistently one of the worst sides in the league while he was at them and were basically being kept up by Hosslou. He scores 11 goals with 3 assists. He gets 11 goals with 3 assists in his second season. And his final season at Alaves, the one where they go down, he scores 14 goals and gets 5 assists. Again, just to re-emphasise, this is a team that doesn't have a great supply chain to give to him either. This is a team that very much were launching balls at him and hoping that he could get on the end of them. He goes to Espanyol this season, and this is where he should have been at Sevilla because they had the option to buy him for 15 million the previous season. They should have exercised that option. Instead, they chose to stick with Enesiri. They sort of chose to stick with Mir. But yeah, he goes to Espanyol already. He's got 12 goals and 2 assists in his appearances so far for Espanyol. That's 43.75% of his goal of their goals this season. He's third in aerial duels in La Liga and in, sorry, he's top in aerial duels in La Liga. He's third across the big five leagues. He's third in a Pichichi race with those 12 goals, and he's seventh for fouls won in La Liga as well. It really is just a kind of story of hard work paying off, because this is a guy that's consistently just got better and better throughout his career. Even though Spain were a bit flat-footed against Scotland in that game, the two sort of, or the instances where Spain looked like they might score were Hosslou, him hitting the bar. He was the nuisance. He was the one factor that Scotland struggled to deal with in the first half. And I just think it really is kind of heartwarming story that this kind of grisly, battling target man is finally getting his rewards. And he's in dreamland now at the age of 33, as you say, scoring a brace for Spain on his debut. There's something pretty sweet and wholesome about him, even if he's kind of a bombastic and aggressive forward. And yeah, I, as I say, I do have a soft spot for him. I think he's one of the most lethal strikers in La Liga. He's one of the hardest to deal with. And this is all despite him playing for ostensibly bad teams. His Espanyol side sits, I think it's 17th or 16th currently. So yeah, I can only imagine what he would do in a good side, and apparently Spain just aren't quite that good side right now.
There we are, Barlow. Well, maybe the listeners will be a little bit softer on Hosslou after having listened to you there. Certainly, I don't think I was in any mood to be softer on Hosslou after his antics, shall we say, at Hampden in Mount Florida yesterday evening. But yeah, an interesting story, and definitely a case of a player taking the scenic route to international football, which is a theme that we enjoy on the Road to Nowhere podcast. Okay, Barlow, that was extremely interesting as always. We'll take a quick break now. We're going to dial in Michael Jones. Michael's been busy down in Westminster, but we're going to speak to him all about my trip to Rome to see the Derby della Capitale. We'll be right back.
In Italy, not too long ago, our own Alistair Madden was at the Stadio Olimpico for the Derby della Capitale between AS Roma and Lazio. In a game unsurprisingly filled with controversy, it was Bianca Celesti who were rewarded with a 1-0 win for their front foot approach. Ali, what was the mood like in such a lauded derby? And was it simply a case of big game management by Maurizio Sarri's side to get a major scoop over the special one?
Yeah, it was a fantastic experience, Michael. We went to Rome on the Friday. We did the Colosseum, Palatine Hill, Roman Forum. We did all the sort of usual spots that you would do as a tourist. And then it was all leading up on the Sunday night to the Derby, which was, yeah, a fantastic experience. The atmosphere was perhaps like nothing I've ever experienced before. And I know that's quite a bold claim to make, and it's maybe a cheap claim to make. Everyone says, oh, this was an amazing atmosphere, but there was something special about this game. I think because the two teams don't really tend to win Serie A, they don't have a huge amount of success. In the Lazio certainly have had some Coppa Italia success recently, and Roma had their Conference League success, but generally speaking, the clubs domestically don't have a huge amount of success. So I think this one in itself almost feels like a crucial part of their season, you know, to secure the bragging rights. And Lazio were fully deserved winners here. It was an interesting game. It was a very fiery game. I think the game had, what, 5 red cards, so 3 for players and 2 for coaching staff, and it did flare up in more ways than one throughout the game. It was quite interesting. On every corner of the Stadio Olimpico, there were firefighters for the steady stream of pyrotechnics, which were finding their way onto the running track around the pitch, or not the running track, but the part around the pitch. So yeah, the atmosphere was amazing. And there was a lot of bite. There was a moment, I think, towards the end of the first half, when Pedro, who'd obviously played for Roma before making that switch across to Lazio, and he didn't put the ball out when the Roma bench felt that perhaps the ball should have been put out. Eventually, Pedro did play the ball out for a throw-in, but at this point, he was right in front of the Roma dugout. He was not too far from the away section, the Roma fans, and so they were giving him absolute pelters. The Lazio bench, understandably, took exception to that, and before you knew it, there was a mass brawl just spilling over onto the field. So that happened on several occasions. Just, yeah, it would erupt into this sort of passion, this sort of anger. And that made the game very interesting, over and above the fact that both teams were going for Champions League football. Both teams have had relatively good seasons. And there were moments of real class. I think Sergej Milinkovic-Savic, quite a frustrated player at times, for me anyway. And you saw that again on Sunday evening. Moments he would do something brilliant, other moments he would just do something a bit ridiculous. But on the whole, I thought that was a real high-quality game. It was a very technical game, very tactical game. Mourinho himself wasn't in the dugout, serving, I think, the second game in a two-match dugout ban. But yeah, generally speaking, there was a lot of quality in the game. I was disappointed with Pedro, I have to say. I know that he is getting on a bit, but his decision making, his end product on the whole was really quite disappointing. But yeah, I think the likes of Milinkovic-Savic, likes of Mattia Zaccagni out on the left wing, yeah, they were ultimately the difference makers. So you had Lazio set out in a sort of 4-3-3, and then and Roma were set up in a 3-4-3, but the three in the front line for Roma weren't as close together as the three in the front line for Lazio. I felt Belotti was really quite isolated at times, and that was obviously exacerbated by Dybala being taken off just at the start of the second half to sort of make up for the fact that Ibanez had been sent off. Ibanez, of course, now probably one of Lazio's best players this season in the derby, what with his slip the first time around to let in Felipe Anderson, and then his red card, which was the most idiotic of red cards. It was a really poor touch, a really avoidable second yellow card if he just controlled the ball properly. But the foul had to be made. Lazio were about to break away, and Ibanez and his other defenders were out of position. So it was almost a necessary yellow, but it was a silly yellow still, because you shouldn't be miscontrolling the ball like that, certainly at a player at that level. But yeah, on the whole, fantastic game of football. And even if we don't consider the wider context, which I'll come to you on, Michael, shortly, even without that wider context of how the teams are faring in the league, how the teams are looking ahead to the sort of final few weeks of the season, I thought this was a really memorable game of football. This was a really, yeah, a bucket list occasion. Before the game, the atmosphere was brilliant. We got the tram out from the centre, and, you know, the public transport in Rome isn't the best, shall we say, but the tram out was good, and we wandered along to the Olimpico. We soaked up that pre-match atmosphere, and you did wonder, is this one of these games where, you know, the atmosphere will be good up until kickoff, and then it'll maybe go a little bit flat? Far from it, Michael. The atmosphere grew and rose, and when Lazio scored their goal, the noise was deafening. The image almost of the whole Lazio bench rising up and running over to the ultras, along with Zaccagni and the rest of the team who were on the pitch. It was quite something, the noise. It was a real goosebumps moment, and quite surreal as well, actually. Before the game, they paraded Sven Jørn Eriksen, who, of course, enjoyed great success at the turn of the century as Lazio manager. So yeah, quite surreal at first. I said to my dad, is that Sven Jørn Eriksen? And then, of course, the Lazio fans started singing his name, and yeah, so it was indeed Sven Jørn Eriksen. And then an eagle appeared. Lazio, obviously, their nickname is the Eagles or the Eaglets. So this mascot eagle appears, and I kept thinking, like, I know that this eagle's well trained, but what happens if it gets spooked? Because there's, what, 65,000-70,000 people in here? And that was at the start of the game, when it was the atmosphere was amazing anyway. But at the end of the game, as part of the celebrations, the eagle handler brings out the eagle and joins in the celebrations. I don't know if you've seen the image, Michael, but there's like Felipe Anderson and a few of the players. Zaccagni's actually up with the ultras. But But the Lazio players are all there celebrating with the ultras, and the Eagles just like loving it. I thought, what happens if that eagle gets spooked? Surely it could just rip their arm off. But yeah, great atmosphere, great experience. And actually speaking, you know, that's probably the best thing, the thing that I enjoy most about going to this game, speaking to the locals, speaking to the fans, getting their view on things. And yeah, that was, yeah, really enlightening evening and a great game of football as well. Yeah, fantastic experience. And hopefully I'll get to go back to the Derby de la Capitale in the not too distant future. Michael, I've rambled on there more about the experience itself and the atmosphere, but I'll come to you for some of the more nuanced aspects of this derby. What does Lazio's win mean for Lazio season and for Roma season? Yeah, what is the wider significance of that 1-0 win for Sarri's side?
Yeah, I think it has big ramifications. I mean, just starting very quickly on that eagle, I feel like they must just be built for big atmospheres, because in the Premier League as well, if you think Crystal Palace, it's Selhurst Park where one flies around as well. So, yeah, it must be a big occasion.
One at Benfica as well. Benfica have an eagle. So, yeah, I'm not too sure how they managed to train the eagles to not get spooked, I suppose, but there we are. maybe we can look at that in another podcast. Maybe venture it into another series, perhaps. Yeah. But anyway, I'll let you continue to make all stop obsessing over the eagle.
No, thank you very much, Ali. Well, yeah, I think like you said, it had big ramifications. It's put Lazio second in the league, Roma fifth. If Roma won the derby, Roma would have leapfrogged Lazio in the league. I think Roma would have come third with a win. So obviously in the league, it has huge ramifications. But I think on the outside, it was, from an external point of view, it was quite symbolic of where the team's priorities supposedly are this season. In the build-up to the derby, Jose Mourinho had made a dig at Sarri, saying that the Europa Conference League trophy now will have to leave Rome because Lazio got eliminated after back-to-back defeats by AZ Alkmaar. But other than that, it's actually been quite a productive month for Lazio. They beat Napoli at the beginning of the month. It was a great strike from Vecino, who scored from distance. A bit of, you know, an unlikely one, but a really good one. They drew Bologna, who are in quite good form at the moment. And then this win, and they've not been scoring goals, but they've been having to deal with the absence of Ciro Immobile, who I believe was on the bench for the derby but didn't come on. And I think, weirdly enough, it's almost benefited Sarri's side in some aspects in terms of the way they play. I think Immobile's link-up is certainly not a strength of how he plays, but he obviously brings a lot of goals, and for Lazio's dominance, they could only score one goal. But with sort of Felipe Anderson dropping in as that false nine and Zaccagni, sort of the players taking it in turns, I think it certainly helps that sort of, you know, you were talking about Zaccagni and Pedro sort of playing as inverted wingers, very much Sarri ball, and it really helps them to link up and get in behind and create a number of chances. And I think he may find himself, Sarri, with a little bit of a selection dilemma when Immobile returns. He's not gone with Italy for the national team, but when he comes back, I think there will be a balancing act for him to see how he does get the best out of, you know, undoubtedly maybe his most important player in terms of value to the club, value to the fans and supporters. But it's going to be a really interesting one to see how he handles that. But another player who didn't get called up to the Italy national team, but solely out of preference, was Mattia Zaccagni, who, yeah, was absolutely outstanding in the derby, could have scored more than one goal, had a couple great efforts from distance and linked up great the whole game. And he's really coming to the fore now for Lazio, and I think he's going to be so important. I mean, I can't believe he's not been called up to the national team, especially when you watch them sort of struggle to link up an attack versus England the other night. But he's on the verge of scoring double digits in Serie A for the first time in his career. He's on 9 league goals now. 4 assists, and he was targeted by Sarri at the start of the season to reach double figures, and he's kind of gone. I read this lovely article by Nicky Bandini where he's kind of gone from that sort of inverted centre forward to an inverted winger as such, and he certainly has the power and pace to play further wide, but I think he did that more in his first season and it didn't quite work as well. But I think he's going to be absolutely key. He's the most valuable player in Serie A, but he's also he's sort of in the top 10 for so many different actions: progressive carries, successful take-ons, goals and assists, so progressive passes. So he's had a really progressive season, I think it's fair to say. And I think Zaccagni will be key to what Sarri wants to achieve with Lazio this season. Yes, they might be out of Europe, but it's quite clear the Conference League in particular wasn't a priority for them this season. And, you know, they're a team that need that Champions League money in order to invest. And I think Sarri will need that in order for him to stay for the long term as well.
Yeah, he enjoyed his goal against Roma, as he well should have enjoyed his goal. And at the end of the game, climbed up and with the ultras, you could tell that he was loving the moment. And I think after watching the footage back of the kind of post-match celebrations, you can see how much it meant to him. Quite an emotional moment for him. And yeah, he was the difference maker. Great player, really exciting player. And yeah, definitely someone who perhaps Mr. Mancini should be looking at for future national team selections. Okay, well, we are going to turn our attention now to some Italian sides who are still in Europe. I'm not saying that as a dig at Lazio, but we're going to turn our attention now to look at Inter Milan and Juventus, who will be playing Benfica and Sporting in the Champions League and Europa League, respectively. And to do so, to look at those Portuguese sides, we're going to be joined by Albert and Barney. So, yeah, I'll let Michael take centre stage. I'll step back now. Enjoy.
Well, I think Barney and Albert need no more introduction, because I'm sure even though Alistair isn't with us right now, he'll have already given you a glowing introduction. I've just learned that you're both brothers, and you're not the only two brothers doing a football podcast. But yeah, Albert and Barney, how are you both?
Very good, thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here. We've been fans of the show for a long time, and it's great to finally work together. So we're very happy to be here.
Yeah, I'd echo that. Yeah, good to meet you, Michael, and everyone involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess we'll begin with that Champions League quarterfinal draw, which was, from my point of view, it was a tantalising one for Italian football fans, with three out of four teams on one side of the draw, which were Italian. Whilst the prospect of a Calcio Champions League finalist is very real, so are those prospects for Benfica, who face Inter Milan in the quarterfinals. For a team who have already eliminated Juventus from this season's competition, Albert, what makes Roger Schmidt's side such a dangerous one to overlook?
Well, dangerous is just one of the many words you could use to describe this Benfica team at the moment, who are really in the best form that a Benfica team has been in for many years. The word that I like to associate with Benfica is professionalism. For me, they ooze professionalism. They are a well-oiled machine where every player in that team performs their function with complete confidence. And I think Roger Schmidt has to be given a lot of credit for the work that he's done at Benfica. This is a team that has unparalleled resources in Portugal, an unparalleled fan base. And despite there being other big teams in this league, they have probably the most financial power in the league compared even to teams like Porto. But that said, it's one thing to have those resources, and it's another thing to use them properly. What we've seen from Benfica in recent years is them squandering those resources, whether it be through poor recruitment or hiring managers on expensive contracts who are quite clearly from the outset not right for the club, naming no names, Jorge Jesus. With Roger Schmidt coming in, the thing that they've done so well is use the resources that they have to be the best that they can be. And in my opinion, what we're seeing now is a Benfica side as good as they probably could be and using those resources well. When it comes to players, I think you see that best in players who, in my opinion, have previously perhaps been a bit inconsistent. And I would highlight players like João Mário and Grimaldo as two examples of that. João Mário, a player who had a good season with Sporting, very controversially switched to Benfica and didn't immediately hit the ground running. A player who had been Obviously has incredible technical ability, as we're seeing now. He's Benfica's joint top scorer in the league from midfield, which is incredible. But he hasn't always been like that. He hasn't always shown what he can do. Grimaldo, again, a player who perhaps, you know, comes with a lot of pedigree. I'm sure he'll be one of the players from the Portuguese league most known around the world to people who don't follow the league. But he's perhaps suffered from a lack of motivation from playing in Portugal. Perhaps he's not always been consistent. There have been those who have doubted whether he's, you know, the player that everybody makes him out to be. He's been linked with Barcelona at times, and I think some people question whether he will ever be that caliber of player. But under Roger Schmidt, he seems to have unlocked some kind of motivation or confidence that wasn't there before. So what I'm trying to get across is a Benfica team that is, once you unlock the potential that that team has, when you unlock the confidence that that's inside them, they start to become a very frightening prospect. And I think that's what we're seeing now. It's been great to see them perform well, not just in the Premier League, but also in Europe, because, you know, a team of Benfica's size, they really should be dominating the Premier League every year. They are this year, but there's always that question mark over the biggest Portuguese clubs about whether they'll be able to translate that domestic dominance into European success. Well, they've been incredible this year in the Champions League. They're unbeaten in the Champions League, and that goes back to not just the group stage, but before that in their qualification campaign, which started all the way at the beginning of August. They finished top of a Champions League group, which included PSG and Juventus. They beat Juventus twice. They drew with PSG twice, and they then dismantled Club Brugge in the round of 16 in a game that looked like their easiest game of the tournament so far. You know, you mentioned in the question that this is a team that's already beaten Juventus, but this is a team that's improved even since then. They've got players like Gonçalo Ramos, who looks like a better player than when they played Juventus. They've got players like David Neres, who was quite raw at the time they played Juventus, but now looks like he's playing at a higher level than that time of the season. And players that I've already mentioned, like Grimaldo, who I think is in some of the best form of his life. I think so. Benfica really is a team that I think people should start taking seriously, despite the fact that they play outside of a top five league, which of course is a fair assessment of a team when you're considering how good they are. I know people are used to one or two world-class players emerging from Benfica each season, players like Darwin Nunes or Ruben Dias, etc. But what if Benfica had a team full of players playing at that kind of level? And I think that's what they're close to at this point in time. So while some might say it's a bit of a dream for a club like Benfica to make it to a Champions League final or potentially even win it, I think that is closer to being reality than people might think.
No, fascinating. And I guess when you mentioned João Mário, we should have maybe coined this fixture with Inter Milan, the João Mário derby. I think I saw him in his first season there. And it obviously, you know, it's great to see that he's found his groove in Lisbon. Just coming to you, Barney, you know, quickly, Inter Milan, they've already had Portuguese opposition this season in Porto as well. And do you think from that game, Benfica will take more positives than they may, in fact, fear playing Inter Milan in the quarters?
Yeah, definitely. I think what we saw from the Inter-Porto tie was a sort of, particularly the second leg, sort of two teams sort of just failing to find any sort of outlet in the attacking areas, and they just couldn't seem to get a goal. And I think that suits. I think Benfica would have seen that and then that, been licking their lips at the prospect of that, because they're both things. Benfica, they've got an incredible attacking trio up top or quadruple, whatever you however you want to call it, but they've also got a really solid defense, and I think that's perhaps something that we don't talk as much about when we're discussing them in the league, because their goal scoring has been phenomenal. But defensively, they've been really, really sound under Roger Schmidt. Perhaps the most exciting part of that defense is Antonio Silva, sort of a young 19-year-old centre back who's sort of burst onto the scene this season, is looking like could be one of the best defenders in the world. The rate he's developed and improved. Obviously, Grimaldo, who Albert's talked about, and Otamendi as well, who's been incredibly good. If we're talking about centre-back partnerships and bringing through a young 19-year-old defender, Otamendi's been key to that. And so, yeah, I think Benfica are going to feel very confident up against Milan. Inter Milan, because I think the prospect of trying to terrorise that defence in Inter Milan's defence, which hasn't been great, and particularly the system they play, I think that sort of play, plays into Benfica's hands. They get so many players forward. I think we've touched on João Mário there. He's a prime example of a player you don't really think about bombing into the box and getting onto the end of crosses, but he's been doing that in the system that Schmitz plays, and that's the reason why he's got so many goals. So I know about Albert, and both of us are quite pretty confident about Benfica against Inter, and I think they should hopefully beat them over two legs.
Yeah, well, I can't wait to see. I mean, I'm hoping for Inter Milan, but yeah, I must say, I think Benfica go into this one favourite as well. And Albert, you mentioned Juventus. Well, coming back to the old lady, their European exploits are not actually over yet, as they have a mouth-watering tie versus Sporting Club in the quarterfinals of the Europa League. It's been a mixed season for the much-heralded Ruben Amorim with the Leos outside of the top three in Portugal, yet impressing in the Champions League despite going out as well. And they obviously produced that magnificent display to overcome Arsenal in the previous round of the competition. With them, do you think hopes are high ahead of Italian opposition in Juventus? And what type of manager is Amorim when it comes to the big occasion?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting one. I think when I originally saw the draw for this, I thought Juventus were going to be tough, you know, just because of the stature of the club, the quality of the players they have. Sporting have very much sort of found themselves with a situation in their squad which is they've had better in the last few years, to put it plainly. I think ever since Amorim took the job, he put together a championship winning a team with real key players in that, the likes of Paulinho, who's now excelling at Fulham. But then over the past 2 years, he's seen those players leave, and and he hasn't really had the resources to replace them. And so it's been quite a complicated season for Ruben Amorim, really. But I think the sort of outlier to that has been the exploits in Europe, which has been really impressive. And I think that what that comes down to is when Amorim first burst onto the scene in Portugal, you know, everyone was blown away by this man. He sort of came with his 5-2-3 formation, which wasn't typical of teams in Portugal, really. He obviously won the league. But since then, we've sort of seen a slight decline. Obviously, they're well out of the title race this season. They're probably struggling to get third place, to be honest, which is not ideal for a club like Sporting, who really see themselves as part of this big three. But Braga are currently ahead of them in this year's title race. Yeah, and I think what that has come down to is sort of managers and other teams sort of sussing out Amorim. You know, he hasn't turned out to be sort of a tactical genius. He just seems to be quite set in his ways, and I think that's been a bit of an issue. But what you can't deny is the guy's man management, and we've seen that with the young players he's brought through over the past few seasons. But we also see that in the Champions League and sort of the way he can get a team together to fight. And certainly in that Arsenal tie, I thought we saw players with huge belief that they would be able to get something, that despite the fact that it was playing arguably one of the best teams in the world this season. So that's the thing for me is whether Amorim can recreate that against Juventus, you know, keep that momentum going. I mean, he's had his squad issues, like I mentioned. I think the attack is, he hasn't worked out his best 11. I think that's for sure. You've got players like Pedro Gonçalves, who scored that incredible goal against Arsenal, basically from the halfway line. He always puts him in whether in midfield or an attack, but he always seems to be changing it. He hasn't sort of given him his right position, which for me is sort of the right wing of attack, but he's been playing him in midfield, the left-hand side. And I think that's been a bit of an issue, particularly when Pedro Gonçalves was sort of arguably the best player. I thought he'd be playing for Liverpool at this point. He was one of the best players we've seen in this league a few seasons ago. And yeah, it's been messy for Amorim. I think it's going to be really interesting. I think certainly Sporting's success this season is all down to Europe now. So they're going to be really, really focused. And I think Amorim, you know, he's got it in him to get those players up for this big Juventus tie.
Yeah, well, his man management, but other aspects seem key. Just quickly coming to you, Albert, before we finish on that. I mean, you talked about Grimaldo before as a bit of a case study of maybe staying in the league for too long. And people may think the same about Amorim because he's been linked to a host of top jobs over the last few years. And I do wonder if he, even though he's not had the best domestic season, if he does navigate away both, you know, he's already done Arsenal, if he does the likes of Juventus and even potentially Manchester United into the semis, do you think his stock would increase higher than ever? And do you think he sees this as a big opportunity for his own career?
To answer the second part of that question first, I would say as a personality, Amorim is not very outwardly ambitious. He will never be the type of manager who gives any kind of suggestion that he's hoping to move on to better things. I think he is probably very proud and happy to be manager of Sporting, genuinely. And I think any kind of further steps he take on in his career will be very well considered. I think he's a manager who will understand that he's in a very good position with Sporting and will not necessarily want to jump ship too soon. I think personally, I think some of the links with bigger clubs that I've seen this season, including recently Spurs, have worried me slightly. My instinct is that perhaps he's not quite ready for a move that big. But that said, I also don't think the smart thing for him to do is to go to a team where he's suddenly going to be a small fish in a big pond. So it's difficult with how he navigates that situation. His next move has to be the right one. And I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that he stays at Sporting, not just next season, but possibly even an extra season after that. And then, of course, it depends whether he can recreate the magic of that title-winning season, whether his stock goes back up. But, of course, if he manages to get Sporting to beat Juventus over two legs, and after doing the same against Arsenal, his stock will be much higher. And I think in world football, just my opinion, of course, but I think we're seeing a desire for new managers, new faces on the managerial scene around Europe. So I think there could well be clubs in Italy, Spain, France that would look at Ruben Amorim and think, well, I'm prepared to take a chance on this guy because he could be the next big thing. He was asked recently in an interview, is he the new Jose Mourinho? And he answered very well, as any Portuguese manager should, that there is, of course, only one Jose Mourinho. And I think that kind of sums up the fact that he is quite humble and he will not jump ship before it's too early, basically.
Yeah, well, I'm sure if he does manage to knock out Juventus, it could even be Juventus themselves looking at him or somebody else in Italy in the next few months. But yeah, thank you so much both for joining me. It's really been great to hear from you both. And obviously, if Benfica and Sporting Club do both progress, I mean, especially with the prospect of that Napoli versus Benfica, not to overlook AC Milan, but in terms of two attacking teams, that would be a sensational two legs. So it may be not too long until we hear from you both again. But yeah, I'll pass the reins back over to Ali now, who will be jumping back on shortly.
Now, of course, the intention was that for this part of the podcast, as I mentioned earlier in the episode, we would speak to Alex and Ninad from the Everybody's Eats podcast about the five youngsters in Ligue 1 who have played the most minutes this season. Now, sadly, due to developments outside of our control, that is no longer going to happen in this episode, but thankfully, that will happen in the next episode, so you can look forward to that in Season 4, Episode 15. So I suppose just to give you a teaser of sorts, we're going to look at Wilson Odobert, the right winger who plays for Troyes. He's 18 years of age. We're going to look at Désiré Doué, the attacking midfielder, lighting up the Roazhon Park for Rennes. He's 17 years of age. We're also going to look at Lesley Ugochukwu, the defensive midfielder, also playing his trade at Rennes. He's 19 years of age. We're going to look at Sahel Kambede, the 18-year-old right back at Lyon. And we're also going to speak about Habib Diarra, who plays as a defensive midfielder at my beloved Strasbourg. He's 19 years of age. So plenty of young players for us to discuss in the next episode. And yeah, just an apology to you, the listener, if you were looking forward to that section. Well, you can look forward to it a little bit more. In a fortnight's time, we'll have that with you. In the meantime, thank you for listening to this varied episode. Thank you for your continued support. Stay safe and stay well. Goodbye.